Today I'd like to look at Exodus chapters 12 to 19. This covers the Passover, the dedication of the firstborn, then the crossing of the Red Sea, the journey to Mount Sinai, the first steps in the organisation of the administration of Israel, and also first steps in the establishment of the covenant. Last week we looked at the plagues and we concluded with this tenth plague, which is quite different from all the others. We saw that it was the great act of deliverance as well as an act of judgment. It was redemption. And this required then, on the part of the people, faith and obedience. I think we're well familiar with the details as to how the people were to go about preparing the lamb and carrying out the ritual for the Passover. The operative verse is chapter 12, verse 13. The blood shall be a sign for you upon the houses where you are, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you. There's the origin of the word Passover. I will pass over you, and no plague shall fall upon you to destroy you when I smite the land of Egypt. The significance of the blood of the lamb, it was a sign, and when the destroying angel saw that sign, he passed over the house. Now here I think we have a very good illustration of the significance of blood. It was a sign of death, specifically substitutionary death. Death had taken place, and it was in the place of those who were under judgment. In other words, the significance was in the meaning and in the sign and the symbolism of the blood. The significance was not in the chemistry of the blood or the content of the blood. It was a sign that a death had taken place to release those who are under judgment. We must always bear that in mind, not only in the case of the Passover, but in the case of the other sacrifices of the Old Testament, and specifically in the case of the blood of our Lord Jesus Christ. We have to get rid of those ideas. We sometimes hear people talk of the chemistry of the blood and of blood transfusions and things like this. These are along the wrong track. They not only miss the meaning, if you follow them through, you'll find they actually undermine the efficacy of the work of Christ. The significance of Christ's death, or the significance of Christ's blood, is that his death was an atonement. He died to take the place of those who were under the judgment of sin, as the same as we have here. That's why it is that when you come to the New Testament, you'll find that the blood of Christ, the death of Christ, the cross of Christ, are used interchangeably as referring to the atoning death of Christ, the sacrificial death of Christ, the substitutionary death of Christ. And it's in that sense that we understand the blood of Christ. Let me give you an illustration. Supposing Jesus was working in his carpenter's shop or walking along the road and he trod on a piece of glass or something and some blood flowed out of his foot. That is not the blood that cleanses, or it's not blood in that sense that cleanses. When we talk of the blood of Christ, we're talking of his death on the cross, his death for sin. And we have to get that straight. We're not concerned with the chemical properties of a red fluid that's flowing through somebody's veins. We're concerned with a death which took place as the sinless substitute died for those who are under judgment. And so it is again that Christ, our Passover, is sacrificed for us. And again, God can say, when I see the blood, I will pass over you. Now that was the symbolism of the blood, and it comes right through the Old Testament sacrifices. In the Old Testament sacrifices, the concern was not with the composition of the red fluid in the animal's body. It was concerned with the fact that this animal took the place of a person who was under the curse of the law and was released because of the atonement which symbolically took place. Because when we come to Jesus Christ, we then have the fulfillment. There are other things connected here with the atonement, or with the Passover rather, which I think we should just take note of. The whole of the Passover feast was eaten in a hurry. Also, none of the meat from the Passover was to be kept overnight. People do tend to be superstitious, and God didn't want anybody pocketing something to become a sort of lucky charm. Also, there was no risk of anything going off if the meat was not kept the next day. So you find that what happened was that the whole of the thing had to be eaten, and what was not eaten had to be destroyed. The people had to eat the Passover in haste and in simplicity because they were to leave in a hurry. You find it referred to here in chapter 12, verses 10 and 11. You shall let none of it remain until the morning. Anything that remains until the morning you shall burn. In this manner you shall eat it, your loins girded, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. You shall eat it in haste. It was a very unceremonious departure. And when the people remembered the Passover in the years that followed, they followed this sort of ritual through to remind them that their redemption was nothing that they themselves could glory in. It was a very unceremonious departure from Egypt, but they had to flee in a hurry. They were reminded of this, that their salvation depended entirely upon the grace and mercy of God. And they were saved because a lamb had died in their place, and so they were released from the judgment that was hanging over their heads. Substitutionary death, and so they remember that in the Passover. And I think it's the same with us, that we must keep before us that our salvation is something which depends entirely upon God. And the Lord's Supper grew out of the Passover, as we know, the evening of the meal when Jesus instituted the Lord's Supper. He took the things that were on the table as part of that feast. And again, the simplicity of the thing is the importance of it. Just bread and wine, just ordinary things that were there on the table. I think stick to this simplicity. Sometimes we do tend to build up a sort of mystique. A lot of paraphernalia sometimes we like to attach to the Lord's Supper, almost trying to gild the lily, one might say. But the essence of the thing was simplicity, that we were saved when we had no hope, and yet God in his mercy saved us by the blood of the Lamb. By simplicity, don't misunderstand me, I'm not saying it should be cheap or common. Some people get the wrong idea and they think that, okay, it's open go and we can be cheap or common or over familiar with the thing. No, it's simple, but it's beautiful. Let's keep it that way. So it was with this Passover. You find in verse 39 another reference to this haste, where they had no time to bake their bread leavened, and they had to cook it as they went along the way. Because if you baked it leavened, that would take time for it to rise, and they had no time for that sort of thing. It had to be cooked in a hurry, flat cakes, toasted, you might say. In verse 39, they baked unleavened cakes of dough which they had brought out of Egypt. It was not leavened because they were thrust out of Egypt and they couldn't tarry, neither had they prepared for themselves any provisions. Another point you notice in verse 9, if you go back there, concerning the meat of the feast, do not eat any of it raw or boiled with water, but roasted, its head and its legs and its inner parts. No cutting up and boiling, but just barbecued, you might say, roasted whole, everything haste, because they had to eat it in a hurry and they had to flee from Egypt. And so this very unceremonious departure was remembered year by year, driving the people back to the point that their salvation was entirely by the act of God. And there's nothing like remembering that in our remembrance. When you come to chapter 13, you find that because God spared the firstborn of his people and their animals, those firstborn belong to him. First two verses of chapter 13. The Lord said to Moses, consecrate to me all the firstborn, whatever is the first to open the womb among the people of Israel, both of man and of beast, is mine. It belonged to God. Therefore it had to be dedicated to God. Now there are three categories here of the dedication of the firstborn. Firstly, concerning clean animals. Now by clean animals, I mean animals that could be offered as sacrifices, such as sheep, goats, or calves. They were dedicated to God by means of a sacrifice. Then you get laws later on detailing how the firstlings of the flock were offered to God. In the case of unclean animals, that is, animals such as donkeys or camels, which could be used but could not be sacrificed, they were offered to God either by breaking the animal's neck. It wasn't cut, there was no blood flowed out. This was to prevent any temptation to use the thing as some sort of sacrifice. It was to have its neck broken and be disposed of like that. Or, and this is the way things were normally done, or a clean animal could be substituted for it. And so you could sacrifice a lamb in the place of the donkey or whatever, and so redeem the donkey by the payment of a lamb in its place. That's a second category. And the third category is human beings. And they were not to be sacrificed on the altar. They were again redeemed or bought back from God by the payment of a price. In Numbers later on, we are told that it was 5 shekels of silver. So all these firstborn belonged to God, and they were either offered or bought back according to the laws here. You'll find it summarized in chapter 13, verses 12 and 13. You shall set apart to the Lord all that first opens the womb. All the firstlings of your cattle that are males shall be the Lord's. Every firstling of an ass, that's the unclean animal, you shall redeem with a lamb, or, if you will not redeem it, and break its neck. Every firstborn of man among your sons you shall redeem. Now that'll provide some background to your further studies in Leviticus and Numbers, and even when you come to the New Testament you find some of the applications that are made there of some of these rituals of the firstborn. We move on from there to the passing through the Red Sea. And the people have now begun their journey to Egypt. And you find in chapter 13, verse 17, that they did not go by way of the coast. Now this was well fortified by Egyptian outposts, and God didn't want the people turning back in discouragement so soon after they had been delivered from bondage in Egypt. And so God took them by a different route. They crossed the Red Sea and went down via the Sinai Peninsula, and then were to enter Canaan from the east rather than go up along the coast. So there's the reference there in chapter 13, verse 17. Do not lead them by way of the land of the Philistines along the coast, because the people may get discouraged and turn back. So they went via the Red Sea. Now when we say the Red Sea, not right through the middle of the Red Sea as we often picture it. If you look at the places on a map, you'll find it was a sort of northern extension of the Red Sea. You're all aware that the Red Sea is an arm of water like this, with two gulfs at the top, the Gulf of Suez and the Gulf of Aqaba. Between these two gulfs is the triangular shaped Sinai Peninsula. And at the apex of this inverted triangle is of course Mount Sinai. So the people came out of Egypt and they crossed this northern extension of the Red Sea somewhere in the line of the present-day Suez Canal, and then followed down the side here until they came to Mount Sinai. The various places are mentioned, and I don't intend going through the details of this journey. Chapter 15, of course, is a magnificent chapter of victory. It's read very often, and once again I want to pass over that and talk about a few other things. The essential point of chapter 15 is in verse 13, where we are told again that God has redeemed his people. Thou hast led in thy steadfast love the people whom thou hast redeemed, and hast guided them by thy strength to thy holy abode. And so they moved on down through various places. And we find that the people were unprepared for these hardships of the wilderness journey. They had lived all their lives in Egypt, and they'd never faced this sort of country before. And soon they ran into problems. Now we know that God was with them, because you have the story of the crossing of the Red Sea and the pillar of fire and the pillar of cloud, and how the pillar guided them. And on one occasion came behind them to separate them from the Egyptians. And then the wind blew and blew the water back, and they went through on dry land. And then after the wind dropped, the water returned to where it was before, and the Egyptians were drowned. God was leading them. But what they had to learn was this: that God's presence among them did not mean that they were going to be immune from the hardships of the way. This is something we have to come to terms with too. Because so often people try to paint a picture of Christianity that if you trust Christ and become a Christian, all your troubles are over and you're going to have a free passage through. And then they get discouraged when they find it isn't quite like that at all. Well, these people had to learn that the presence of God among them did not make them immune from the ordinary hardships people face. And the same it is with Christians. The ordinary difficulties that people face in life, God doesn't give us any problem that as Christians we won't face them. But what he does teach us is that when we do face them, we can, through the exercise of faith and obedience, prove him in an exceptional way. And that's why it is that James gives us the very unusual and hard to take advice that we're to count it all joy when we have these testings coming our way. Very easy to say, not so easy to do. But these situations which arise are no indication that God is not with us. Rather, they are opportunities where we can prove God in the various circumstances we meet. The people ran out of water, and they complain, and so you know the story of the water provided for them here at Marah. And then later on they came to an oasis at Elim and had some more. But you see how they complained when they had no water. And God promises them that if they trust him, then he will look after them. They'll have their difficulties, but he'll still provide through the difficulties. Not only provision of water, but as you come down through chapter 15, verse 26, he says, if you hearken diligently to the voice of the Lord your God, and do that which is right in his eyes, and give heed to his commandments, and keep all his statutes, I will put none of the diseases upon you, which I put upon the Egyptians, for I am the Lord your healer. And so he says once again, I promise to be with you. But notice that the people are required on their part to be obedient. You'll see this coming through all the time. The people were to live in an attitude of faith and obedience. And if they weren't following in faith and obedience, well then of course they couldn't claim the promises which look so rosy. Illustrated further when you come to chapter 16. This time the people complained that they had no food. Last time it was no water. This time it's no food. And so if people don't have one thing to complain about, they'll soon find something else to complain about. And human nature hasn't changed very much over a few thousand years. This time God promises that he'll give them manna. Now once again, in providing this manna for them in chapter 16, God was giving them the opportunity to demonstrate their faith and their obedience. These are the things God is always calling from his people in response to his acts of grace towards them. He says to them, you trust me and you obey me. Don't keep any of the manna overnight. It'll go bad. I'll give you sufficient for your needs each day. No more, no less, but I'll give you sufficient. Now you trust me and I'll give it to you. And we find that some of the people didn't trust him. Just in case they didn't get enough the next day, they kept some of it overnight. And we know that it went off. And then he said, when it comes to Friday, I'll give you twice the amount on Friday to save you having to collect any on Saturday, which is the day of rest. And once again, here was an opportunity for the people to demonstrate their trust in God. Once again, they failed. So the whole of this exercise is God teaching his people. And we're to look at these stories in this way. God is teaching his people things they need to know. Chapter 16, verse 4, really gives us the clue to the understanding of this chapter. The Lord said to Moses, behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may prove them whether they will walk in my law or not. If you go down to verse 19, Moses said to them, let no man leave any of it till the morning. But they did not listen to Moses, and some left part of it till the morning, and it bred worms and became foul, and Moses was angry with them. And the other issue, in verse 27, where on the seventh day some of the people went out to gather, and of course they found none. Again, Moses is angry with them, and the Lord says, how long are they going to be so stubborn? When you come to chapter 17, once again you find the opportunity for them to demonstrate their faith. Now here we have the well-known story of Moses striking the rock at Rephidim, and then in the second half of the chapter we have the story of their victory over the Amalekites. The Amalekites were a race of wild and woolly desert nomads. They were descended from Esau, and they were a constant thorn in the side of the Israelites. And we know the story there, how that as they came and attacked the Israelites, we have Moses praying, and we have Aaron and Hur holding up his hands. And as long as he prayed, Israel was winning, and once he stopped praying, the enemy was winning. The lesson, again, is very obvious for us, and many sermons on prayer have been preached from this section. You see how that their victory is depending upon their faith and their trust and their obedience. They've got to keep God's law, they've got to walk in his ways, and they've got to be trusting. Now, if you summarize those stories that I've skipped over, what God has done is he has proved to these people in this 3-month period between when they left Egypt and when they arrived at Sinai, he's proved to them that he will meet any emergency which might arise. He gives them no guarantee they won't meet emergencies, but he says when you do meet them, then you trust and obey, and I'll see you through. So God doesn't write open checks for us, whereby we can sit back and take things for granted and think that we're going to sail through and hopefully God will bail us out when we get slack. God is keeping us on our toes all the time, and that's the way it should be. If you look at the four illustrations we just had, I think you'll find they cover most of the possibilities which the people are going to meet in the way of difficulties and hardships. You had a shortage of water, a shortage of food, the problem of disease, and war. Now when you think of it, physically speaking, they are the four difficulties that people such as this are going to face. These are the four problems that a journeying people like Israel will face in life as they go from point A to point B. And in each of those shortages, or each of those crises, shortage of water, shortage of food, danger from disease, or danger from raiding desert nomads, whatever way it was, God says, there you are, I have proved to you that I will deliver you if you trust and obey. And I think, again, we can take that promise for ourselves. We can take those illustrations to ourselves and realize that God is doing his work, provided we do our part. Sometimes you get a very sort of pat approach to Christianity, people preaching on all the promises of God and all the great things we can expect, and it just becomes a little bit too cozy for our own good. I don't believe that this very bland approach we have to Christianity is something that the Bible teaches. And we read the New Testament, and many times we read the things that Jesus says, and they really scare us. I think they're meant to scare us. That's the whole point of it. God wants to keep us on our toes. He wants us to have assurance and confidence, but he never wants us to have complacency. And so these people are learning their lessons as they go along. You come to chapter 18, and Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, comes along and meets them, and he finds that Moses is being burdened because of the heavy load of responsibility upon him. Not only is Moses being burdened, but so are the people. These people are not angels, and they've already got their conflicts. They brought out with them from Egypt, I guess, chickens and ducks and a few animals they had or whatever they could salvage. And there were disputes over who owned what, and people were having gripes with each other, and there were conflicts over who was camping in the wrong tent, I guess. All sorts of things were happening, and they were bringing their disputes to Moses and Paul. Moses couldn't handle them all, and the people had to wait so long to get Moses to listen to them that many of them were getting sick and tired of it. And Jethro said, look, what you need is some helpers. 70 men are appointed. And so we have now the first steps in the administration of the people. Remember that these people, Israel, had never governed themselves before. They had been a bunch of slaves, and they had been told what to do by their Egyptian overlords. The nearest they got to any sort of administration was a few foremen among the Israelites who helped supervise their slaves. Now they were going to govern themselves. They had no experience in this. And so you find that God is going to settle them down at Mount Sinai for the next 12 months. And during that 12 months, he's going to organize them. And he's going to give them some laws they can live by. He's going to tell them about their administration and how they can handle difficult cases when they arise. That's what I'm going to look at next week when we do chapters 20 to 23. Very fascinating chapters, the sorts of chapters we normally skip right over because they're dead boring. But actually, there is some really good teaching there, and I want to spend next Sunday on chapters 20 to 23 as we look at the early steps in organizing the administration. I think we should look at the whole of Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers in this light. And sometimes people go off on a sort of mystical trip, and they have all sorts of typological speculations and pictures of all sorts of glorious things they find in these rather strange books. Really, I think they're missing the whole point of it. God gives instruction to his people that's relevant to them. He doesn't give them instruction that's going to be relevant to somebody else in 2,000 or 3,000 years' time. He gives them something relevant to them. If we can understand these people of Israel travelling through the bush like this, I think we'll find a lot more meaning in these books of Exodus, Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy. You see, these people before had lived in a flat, sandy country. Now they're going to live in a country of hills and valleys. They had never been farmers before. Up until now, they were all brick builders, labourers and road diggers. Now they're going to be farmers. And they had to have some time to sort out what they're going to do, and so you find instruction is given for them. They were travelling through the bush where they met all sorts of animals. They didn't know one from another, possibly, because they lived in Egypt. Which one should they eat and which one shouldn't they eat? God gave them some simple rules of thumb to follow. They were going to live in a land of varying seasons. Previously they lived in Egypt where you only got the annual flooding of the Nile and that provided the fertility for the soil. But now they're going into an entirely different country. And so all these instructions God is giving them are relevant to them. And once we see them in that light, I believe they become a lot more meaningful both for those people and for us. God is, if I can use this expression, he's down to earth. And he's giving instruction which people can use in their own situations. And I'll more of that next week when we look at chapters 20 to 23. I want to conclude with a brief look at chapter 19, which discusses the institution of the covenant. Now the operative words are from verse 3, where Moses went up to God and the Lord called to him out of the mountain and said, thus you shall say to the house of Jacob and tell the people of Israel, you have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if you will obey my voice, notice again, if you will obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my own possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. And these are the words which you shall speak to the children of Israel. And so Moses came and called the elders of the people and set before them all these words which the Lord had commanded him. And all the people answered together and said, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do. A covenant is an agreement between God and his people. But never let us think that it's an agreement which God's people and God negotiate as equals. God chooses his people in his sovereign grace. He chooses them because he chooses them. And he says, I'm going to make you my people, not because you're better than anybody else. In fact, in many ways they were worse than many of the other nations, as we are told in the book of Deuteronomy. But God chose them, and he said, I'm making you my people, and I'm taking you into a covenant relationship with myself. Now here are the laws I'm giving you, and this is what I require of you. God chose them in his grace, and their only response is one of total submission. And it's exactly the same with us as we come into the new covenant. God chooses us by his grace. It's not by works of righteousness which we are saved. It's only in his mercy that he saves us. And our response is again faith and obedience, total submission. All that the Lord has said, we must do. And so then the people are committed to this covenant. And if you go across to chapter 24, you'll find here the covenant is now enacted. And we have again a blood ritual. In verse 6, Moses took half of the blood and put it in basins, and half of the blood he threw against the altar. He took the book of the covenant and read it in the hearing of the people, and they said, all that the Lord has spoken we will do and will be obedient. Moses took the blood and threw it upon the people, and said, "Behold the blood of the covenant which the Lord has made with you," in accordance with all these words. So half of the blood he threw against the altar, which represented God. The other half of the blood he sprinkled upon the people. They were bound together by blood. The covenant was sealed by blood, which was an ancient ritual going back to the time of Abraham. But the people have now come through the Passover, and they've realized that blood has this special significance. It has a significance of cleansing and atonement as well, of releasing those who are under judgment of sin. And I believe that when we come to this enactment of the covenant, it's not only sealing the covenant by blood, but it's cleansing the people so that they enter the covenant with a clean sheet. They start as God's people from there. And so it is with us. As we come into union with Christ, we find that Jesus says to us, "This is my blood of the covenant, which is shed for you for the forgiveness of sins." And so we then come in to the covenant relationship with God, and we now are his people. And so we and Peter are told that we are the chosen race, the royal priesthood, the holy nation. We are God's own people, that we may declare the wonderful deeds of him who called us out of darkness into his marvelous light. We're people of the covenant. May we live like it. Let us pray.